With more than 200 private and 8 public terminals, collectively known as the Port of Houston, it is the nation's largest port for waterborne tonnage and an essential economic engine for the Houston region, the state of Texas, and the U.S., supporting over 1.5 million jobs throughout the state of Texas and over 3.3 million jobs nationwide. Dr. Joseph A. Pratt of the Houston History Project described the Houston Ship Channel in his letter from the editor in Houston History Magazine's fall 2014 issue entitled Dredge to Excellence, 100 Years of the Houston Ship Channel. He said that the Ship Channel is, quote, the economic backbone of the region. It has shaped the region's can-do image, giving it a national and international identity, contributed to a distinctly Houston culture. You're listening to Ship History Radio from the Steamship Historical Society of America. Through recording, preserving, and educating, our mission is to share the impact of engine-powered vessels, their crews, and their passengers with future generations. My name is Amy Bachari, and I'm the Education Director. In honor of Black History Month, today we'll be discussing race and labor on the Houston Ship Channel with Jason Terrio, an independent professional historian and consultant based in Houston, Texas, who specializes in historical research and writing services, focusing on energy, environment, business, and culture along the Gulf Coast. Jason and I both received our graduate degrees at the University of Houston and worked for the Center for Public History's Houston History Project, which has an oral history program, publishes the Houston History Magazine, and maintains an archive in the university's libraries where the oral histories are preserved. Jason conducted a series of oral histories on the Port of Houston back in 2006 and interviewed individuals with a long history of working at the Port of Houston and on the Ship Channel. Today, after we talk to Jason, you'll hear segments of his oral history with Charles Mills, who spent 50 years in the maritime industry. Originally from Galveston, Texas, he joined the U.S. Merchant Marine in the late 1930s, serving in an integrated unit and sailing for Likes Brothers Shipping. The Merchant Marine primarily transports cargo and passengers during peacetime, but in times of war, they support the U.S. Navy. At the time, all branches of the U.S. military were segregated. Before we dive into that history, it's important to understand how the Houston Ship Channel came to fruition. The Allen brothers, in an 1836 advertisement entitled The Town of Houston, stated that, quote, vessels from New Orleans or New York can sail without obstacle to this place. Their ad described a future for Houston they hoped to achieve, but it did not match the present reality. In fact, it wouldn't be until the following year, in January 1837, that Captain Thomas Wigg Grayson would sail the small paddle-wheel steamer Laura from Galveston to Houston, marking the first time that the Buffalo Bayou was fully navigated to the then makeshift town of Houston. In 1899, Galveston was the biggest cotton port in the country and the third busiest overall. 45 steamship lines served the city, among them the White Star Line connecting Europe to Galveston. The city was reputed to have more millionaires per square mile than Newport, Rhode Island. Houston had some catching up to do if the Allen brothers' dreams of putting Houston on the map were to come true. Fate would have it that Houston would reign supreme, but at a devastating loss to Galveston. On September 8, 1900, the deadliest natural disaster in American history occurred when one of the worst Atlantic hurricanes hit Galveston. Between 6,000 and 12,000 people died. Some 4,000 homes, churches, and commercial buildings, and almost all small vessels in the area, including tugs, barges, schooners, and fishing boats, were completely destroyed or severely damaged. Most of the larger steamships that were tied up at Galveston wharves or anchored nearby suffered damage as well, but most of the crew on these vessels weathered the storm aboard the steel ocean-going vessels. While Galveston was rebuilding, Houston worked toward its deep water port, but by 1909, the bayou had only been dredged to 18.5 feet. Momentum was gained after the Panama Canal opened on August 15, 1914, and less than a month later, on September 7th, the dredging of a deep water channel to Houston was complete. The first ship to deliver cargo, the William C. May, arrived on September 26, 1914. The Houston Ship Channel was built on the can-do attitude of businessmen, but since its inception, it has prospered because of its workers. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jason. Tell us a little bit about your background and what your area of focus is.
Yeah, Amy, thanks for having me on your show. I'm looking forward to chatting with you. and your audience. So I'm an independent historian, and I got started working on history projects 25 years ago when I was 25 years old. It started by interviewing my grandfathers about their World War II experience. And that grew to a neighborhood project, oral history project, and then a community-wide. And before you know it, I had interviewed over 150 World War II veterans from South Louisiana and decided to go to graduate school. I was living in Houston, went to the University of Houston, got a master's degree there, stuck around for a PhD, enticed by some really innovative oral history projects that was funded by the Department of the Interior, U.S. Department of the Interior, on a history of the offshore oil and gas industry along the Gulf Coast. That agency was known as the Minerals Management Service. We had a series of projects that funneled through the University of Houston that I got an opportunity to work on, including this oral history of folks who were involved in the Port of Houston and the Houston Ship Channel. And then from there, I got a PhD and went to the Harvard Kennedy School of Government as a energy fellow postdoc for a year, which is very interesting. And then decided that I could branch out on my own and become an independent research historian. And I've been doing that, serving in that capacity as a consultant since 2012. So most of what I do is I'll write books for companies or nonprofits or sponsored histories, whatever you want to call them. I do life story videos for people and families and help folks write their memoirs or produce their memoir books. And then I'll work for lawyers involved in litigation, doing research there. And I'm also a host and a producer of two podcast shows and all kind of neat little things. So it's been an interesting run this far, but much of that is because of the experience that I had at the University of Houston, which is something pretty neat that you and I share back in the day. So thanks for having me on.
Why don't you talk a little bit about the oral history project at the University of Houston, what the process is, and how you came to work on the topic of the Ship Channel?
I want to say around 2004, 5, and 6, the University of Houston partnered with University of Arizona and LSU through this partnership with the federal government, the Department of Interior, as I mentioned before, to document the history of the offshore oil and gas industry and the businesses and the communities that support that industry along the Gulf Coast, from Texas, you know, Brownsville, Texas, through Louisiana, all the way through, you know, lower Mississippi, Gulf Coast, and even Alabama. It's a regional industry that is pretty dynamic, and it's, you know, it's got a 100-year history on it. You know, Houston has always had a big presence in that through the Ship Channel and the businesses that that boomed along the Ship Channel in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, and certainly in the post-World War II era. So I got involved in that as a graduate student, and I was able to carve out a segment of that oral history series project to focus on people who had a long history either working at the Port of Houston, in the maritime business writ large, and even, you know, had experiences as pilots, as ship channel pilots. So the 15 or so folks who I interviewed were all in their 80s, you know, 70s and 80s. So this was in, you know, 2006. This is 20 years ago. They'd be 100 years old by now. In fact, there is one guy, you know, still alive, 104 years old, Charles Mills, we'll talk about in a minute. But it was fascinating, you know, the general history of the Ship Channel for your listeners. Galveston, which is the largest inhabited island in the United States, Galveston Island, there's probably, I don't know, today, maybe 15, 20,000 people that live there, maybe more. Galveston, in the late 19th century and early 20th century, major cotton exporting port area. So you had the Mississippi River and you had the railroads that were coming down. And so a lot of the cotton from the interior of the United States and other food grains and textiles and whatnot were coming down via railroad mainly, and then being shipped out at Galveston. So Galveston was a big deal. And then you had the major storm of 1900 that wiped out the island. And then 15 years later in 1915, another big massive storm finished the island off. And so what the visionaries, the leaders of the city of Houston, what they did, business leaders in Houston, they coordinated with their elected officials, you know, heavy hitting senators, and got the federal government to agree to cost share the construction of a 50-mile ship channel from the center of downtown Houston, which became the port of Houston. There's a natural bayou there called Buffalo Bayou. And so they essentially dug a ship channel all the way down to Galveston Bay. And this was opened in 1914. And so the folks in Galveston who were slow to recover watched as the ships came up the channel and essentially took away that that enterprise, that business. And so, you know, part of the reason why Houston is such the powerhouse economic driver in this region in the United States, one of the largest ports in the United States, is because of that ship channel. It's part of the reason why it's, you know, called the energy capital of the world, part of the reason why NASA relocated here. And so it's an interesting story. And a lot of these guys who I'd interviewed had early experiences in the 30s and the 40s as pilots and longshoremen and merchant mariners and et cetera. So really the interview series was to capture those individual stories to kind of help tell the history of the Port of Houston and the ship channel from that earlier period.
And you mentioned earlier about a man who is now over 100, Charles Mills. Can you talk a little bit about his oral history and why it was so important to record his story?
Yeah, so Charles Mills, an African-American merchant mariner during World War II in the early days. And he was a native of Galveston, born and raised. In fact, his he told me that his grandfather had come from Mississippi to build the seawall that was constructed shortly after the infamous 1900 storm that I mentioned earlier killed just about everybody on the island. So if you're familiar with the geography of Galveston, there's a 17-foot high seawall that protects the eastern half of the island where most of the people live, you know, the old historic downtown. And so that's how he ended up down there. And so, you know, you kind of think about it, you grow up on an island where you're surrounded by water and, you know, everybody there is employed in some way. Everybody in his family, at least, was employed in some way in the shipping business, whether you were on a ship or you were on the docks, you know, loading and offloading cargo. So he kind of grew up in that environment. And then interestingly enough, he was elected to go to a major convention for the National Maritime Union in 1937. There was a big strike that was occurring nationwide. It was affecting the Gulf Coast region. And he was 17 years old, a black guy, you know, going up to New York to represent, you know, this very important union and their, you know, their membership. And so that sort of launched him into a career of representing maritime union. And he had a long career there. But before that, he ended up as a merchant marine on a Liberty ship, one of the first Liberty ships to come out of the Port of Houston. Brown and Root, the famous contractors, fabricators, they had a shipyard. And they were putting out Liberty ships, you know, beginning 1941, 42, and he was on one of the first ones. It was called the David Terry. It was a break bulk cargo Liberty ship. And he was a merchant mariner on that ship. And interestingly enough, the merchant marines, which was a branch of the armed forces, was the only branch that was integrated. And so because it's specifically in Galveston, you had, you know, a majority of those who worked on the docks were Black. And so, you know, he wanted to join the Navy. He wanted to do his duty for his country. But he wanted to be on the ship and he wanted to go overseas. And so the Merchant Marine provided that opportunity for him. You know, how interesting, and that you think about it, that time frame, early 1940s, you know, still racial issues in the United States were, you know, very controversial. You know, we had not turned the corner yet as far as civil rights in the late 1950s and 60s. There was, you know, still some time to go and a lot of work to be done in that area. But, you know, serve on a ship with Blacks and whites touring around the world. And I asked him, I said, you know, were there any issues? And he says, not really. You know, we realized that there was a job to do, and that you had to have trust in the guy working in front of you and behind you, regardless of what color they were, or where they came from. And he said, it didn't take too long, you know, before you realized that you have to count on each other. You know, these trips were sometimes 12 months, in U-boat infested waters. He spent 40 years working for the Union after the World War II. So, it was a pleasure to interview him. And in fact, as of today, 2025, he is still alive, and going. And so he's 104 years old.
At some point, the Port of Houston surpassed Galveston. When did that happen, and how did that happen?
Well, after the 1900 and 1915 storm, the economy in Galveston began to go down. And the waterfront in Galveston was owned privately by a family, the Seeley Hutchins family. And they impeded the progress of that port. They did not want to expand beyond what they already had. They did not work with the railroads after the 1915 storm. They did not work with the railroads to come back into Galveston. The railroads found that they could save money and time by stopping in Houston because they didn't have an incentive to go to Galveston. Galveston waterfront did not begin to move until they sold that and it became a port authority. That's when Galveston began to scratch their way out. But they were so far behind that they will never be able to recover enough to either really compete with Houston.
Tell me a little bit about growing up in Galveston and what made you want to get involved in maritime industry.
Growing up in Galveston was continuously in my life. So I had some cousins who started going to sea. And they would come back and tell stories. So I was trying to get into the Navy originally. The only job that I could get in the Navy was cooking. One of my cousins, when he came in, he said, look, there'll be some jobs coming up because the strike is over. In 1936, 37, they had a big strike. And a lot of the ships were tied up. In 1937, the large group of Blacks who were congregated in Galveston, and we stayed very close together. After the big strike in 1936-37, the National Maritime Union, it was not the National Maritime Union then, it was another union, held their first convention in May 1937. And then at that time, I was the youngest member of the group, and they elected me to go to New York to the convention. I wasn't quite 17.
How many group members did y'all have out of Galveston?
Must have been, I would say at least 60. Okay. At least 60 blacks went out. All of them, there wasn't many American blacks. Most of the blacks were from the West Indies, Jamaica, Trinidad, Puerto Rico, and Cuba. I would say out of that group, there may have been a dozen American blacks, because American blacks were not that interested in going to sea in the Merchant Marine. So from that, going to that convention, I was elected as one of the founding fathers of the National Maritime Union. So I'm a chartered member, the youngest guy there. We in the deep sea industry was not too involved as far as wages and working conditions with the port authorities. But we did cooperate with the longshoremen, who had to deal directly with the port authorities through the various stevedoring companies. Stevedoring companies would hire the longshoremen for the discharge and the load and discharge of the cargo. The port authority obligation was to provide a safe and secure area for those vessels to come in and discharge that cargo. We had to cross their property. So we, in the deep sea industry, to my knowledge, until 9/11, we never had any problems with the Port Authority and the Port of Houston. Our working conditions during that period were very good, because anytime we went to them for any problems that we may have run into with one of our steamship companies who had a problem, we worked with the steamship companies very closely. So we went to the Port Authority, and during that period, I found that cooperation with them was very good. The first cleared ship from the Likes fleet to Puerto Rico, I became a member of that crew and on deck until after I left to come ashore as an official of the National Maritime Union. I remember that with Likes, we used to come up to the docks here, city docks in Houston, Manchester, or the Army base and load. And when we were going back out, passed right by Galveston. There was no cargo there. The sugar refinery in Sugar Land, they would bring in sugar occasionally to Galveston. But most of the time, we would dump that sugar in New Orleans. And they would load it on trains and bring it all the way to Sugar Land, or trucks. And then later, we would start the loading, offloading some sugar in Houston. But Galveston used to concentrate on sulfur and sugar. The breakbulk cargo that was loaded here, Galveston could have received some if they had a working relationship with the railroad. Likes had the largest fleet out of the Gulf, the West Gulf, and they had a number of ships that were running down to the West Indies, Cuba, Puerto Rico, Santo Domingo, and the East Coast of South America. So I stayed with Likes from 1937 until about 1940, and I became adventurous, and I made several trips with Coastwise called Clyde Mallory Line. The next thing you know, the war came along. I went to work in a shipyard temporarily until my shipping car got old enough. Shipped out continuously from then until the Brown Shipyard in Houston. They started building Liberty ships, and the first Liberty ship that was built in the Brown Shipyard, it crew out of Galveston, and we loaded in Houston, in Galveston, and picked up the convoy off the coast of Florida, and we went to the Middle East. They had a mix-up in the orders where we were supposed to go. We were supposed to go to India, and the sister ship was supposed to go to the Middle East. And so we stayed anchored outside the Tigris and Euphrates River in the Persian Gulf for over 6 months.
What was the name of that ship?
The David S. Terry. It was the first one that was built. It was operated by United Fruit Company. They were the operators for it.
I'm curious, how did you get to be a crewman on that ship?
Well, I was registered in the shipping hall in Galveston. The American Merchant Marine was the only service that was integrated. So to keep it integrated, most of the blacks were living in Galveston. Most of the whites were living up here in Houston. They had very few blacks that lived and shipped out of Houston. They all shipped out of Galveston because of the Likes fleet. In order to keep that balance of black and white, they shipped some out of Houston and some out of Galveston. The deck department came out of Galveston, and we were integrated. The black and whites came out of Galveston and the deck department. I like to emphasize that because all the rest of the services were segregated, and we were integrated long before anybody ever thought about integration. Blacks and whites lived in the same quarters, ate at the same tables, and did the same hard work.
Was there ever any animosity between the two?
Occasionally, yes, you run into some of it, but it wasn't anything that caused any grave distress to anybody. Whenever it happened, it was always some of us there to arbitrate it, get it straightened out. But on that 13-month trip, we only had one fight between the black and the white, and that was really, that was broken up in a hurry.
What do you think explains the cohesiveness of the group, the black and the white? Why do you think there weren't as many racial problems?
Well, I believe because when people realize they have to work together, there are not a lot of people there to do this work, that you have to watch my back and I watch your back. People can get along. If people really want to get along, they'll get along. Now, we had people naturally that would never ship on the ship where there was a black, but there were few. So I shipped continuously during the war. I was on one ship that got torpedoed. I was running a training program. They had these rubber suits. I can't remember the name of them, but these rubber suits, they would take crew members and send them to the school, and they would come back and train the rest of the crew. And I was standing on a hatch, number four hatch. We were heading for England. And the convoy hadn't broken up, but we were just thinning out. Some ships were going one direction. So we only had about two or three DEs running with us at that time. Torpedo hit us. Blew me off the ship out into the water. There was a standard order. Don't turn to come back to pick up anyone. But the captain of this English destroyer, DE, came back twice. First time I missed the hook. They had a big hook, and they'd catch it. So when I missed it the first time, I said, well, I believe this is it, because the water kept coming into that suit. They were faulty. And the water would come in because you couldn't tighten it up enough without choking yourself. It was like a wetsuit, but it was bulky, real bulky. They were built in real bulky, heavy weights in the bottom to keep you upright. If you were on a ship that torpedoed and you had a chance to get into the suit, which very few times would you have that much time to get into the suit, that this would keep you afloat till they pick you up. But it didn't work. It didn't work. So when you go up on a wave like this, and when you go up on the wave, you can see around you. So I saw the DE turn, make another turn. I said, well, he's coming back. And that's a direct violation of order. So when they came back, he slowed down even more. With that risked his crew. So then they were hollering at the rail, catch the hook, yank, catch the hook, yank. And I caught it, and they took me aboard. So then they took me into Liverpool and they sent me back home. And then I had an occasion on another ship that got torpedoed, but the torpedo didn't explode. It was a limited tanker, and one of the tanks was slack. I mean, there's nothing in it. And the torpedo went right on through. Right on through out the other side. Everybody says, gee, this is unusual for that to happen. And everybody said, gee, we are happy it happened. We were blessed. But we were on the way to Philadelphia. So I never had anything to scare me so much in all my life. When I got knocked over in the water, it scared me, yes. But this seemed to scare me even more because it was a Liberty tanker, and it was loaded with jet fuel. If that thing had exploded, we never would have made it. Jet fuel would have blown up. So I think that scared me more than anything else. So I came home and I stayed a couple of months and then I went back.
So what happened at the end of the war? Did you make it back to Galveston?
Well, yes. I went to New York and I started living in New York for a while after that. Before the war was over, I decided that I was going to take a stab at becoming a union rep. So in 1946, I filed for election and I won. So they sent me back to New York. In the meantime, in 1946, I also got married. And a marriage that was a blessed marriage. We are still together 60 years. Then we went to New York. So I stayed as an official. I took a couple of leaves, made a couple of trips during that period. But from 1946 to September 1, 1989, I stayed on as an official. They sent me to New York first. And then from New York, I went to Baltimore. And from Baltimore to Houston, Mobile, New Orleans, and I retired. Well, when I went to New York what they call field patrolman, my job was in the contract enforcement department. We formulated and negotiated and enforced contracts. The field patrolman, you were assigned wherever the agent who was in charge of that department would assign you. A lot of times you had to go into areas, Philadelphia, Virginia, places where they had problems with the contracts. So we did a lot of traveling. I worked in New York for about 5 years, and then I went to Baltimore because we had some internal problems there. So I was sent in there to try to clear that up, and I wind up staying in Baltimore. So I worked out of Baltimore through down to close Virginia, Savannah, Georgia. And then we had an election, and the fellow got elected for Houston. Now, I'd already been in Baltimore for about 12 years. They asked me to come down to Houston to train this fellow. I said, okay. So I came down, and after 3 months, I called him and said, well, look, I think this guy can handle it, and I'm ready to go back. When do I leave? So he asked me, he said, well, look, aren't you from Texas? I said, yes. Why? He said, well, you want to stay down there? He said, but before you answer that, you ask Wilhelmina. That's my wife's name. So I called her. I said, they're talking about leaving me in Texas. What do you think? You want to come down here? She said, when do we leave? We came to Texas. They bumped me up to another title. I was the director of political action for the West Gulf. So I naturally got involved in a lot of politics, working with the Port Authority, City Hall, and we were able to have a working relation with them, but that was very good. So then I stayed here 16 years and I got transferred again. But transferred into another area where we had some problems. And then I got transferred to New Orleans. I was a troubleshooter or a cleanup man, you might say, because every time they had a problem, they would send me.
What were some of the problems?
A lot of internal stuff. When I was sent into New Orleans, we had at that time group, a communistic group, and they would, now this is back 47. I'll give you a little history about the NMU. The NMU, when they first broke from the ISU, they were led by communists, members of the Communist Party.
In the United States.
They had a very strong cell in New York. So the living conditions at that time were very bad. The wages were low, living conditions, sleeping and feeding was very low. So the communists who were then members of the ILWU, which was another union, they broke away and organized maritime work or something. I can't remember exactly what it was. And then they struck. Got most of the people to go along. They convinced them that the wedges would be better, the living conditions. So they went on strike. And they tied up the waterfront from Brownsville to Boston.
What year was that?
1936-37.
That was the big strike.
Big strike. So these people were still around at that particular time. And we, when I say we, there was a group of us that were against it. And the industry had gotten sold because the Maritime Administration was putting pressures on the union to clean house. And we were trying to clean these people out. So when I went to New Orleans, there was a fight between the communists and the non-communists. Completely disrupted the port. So I was sent down to relieve them until such time as there was a hearing held. And when I stayed on about 3 months, when the hearing was held and over, we had overcome the communists. And so I went back to New York at that time. So that's, the communists had a lot to do with organizing of the National Maritime Union. Yes, they did that. And in fact, during the war, the FBI would pick out certain people, and I was one of them, because I was a charter member of the National Maritime Union, and most of those people who were then charter members were members of the Communist Party. So they came down to a ship. I was in Lake Charles. I came down. They came down to a ship and interviewed me. And they asked me, remember the Well, you associated with them? Yes. They had beautiful parties, plenty of food, plenty of booze. And you never joined? I said, no, I ate their food, drank their booze, and went home. I never became a member of the party. But I got a lot of help from the party. They helped me, because at the time that I was trying to get my father my education, they didn't have a program in the union for those officials who wanted to upgrade themselves educationally wise. But the communists came up with a program. Said, if you want to go back to school, we pay for it. We went back, a lot of us went back to school. So that I had a very enjoyable life. The union was good to me. They gave me an opportunity to go back to school for my education, and an opportunity to rear my family and give them a good life, a good education. So I really hated to see the National Maritime Union have to merge with another union, but it was the best thing for the industry at this time. I was always an advocate that for one unlicensed union. We didn't need two or three unlicensed unions because we were continuously fighting one another. The master mates and pilots had one union. The engineers, one union. The radio operators, one union. So why did the unlicensed personnel need two or three unions? And that really hampered our advancement in wages and living conditions for not only the men on the ships, but their families. 7 years ago, the union, National Maritime Union, decided that it was time to merge with the Seafarers International Union, and I supported that. I think that was the best thing for us. The industry is beginning to grow again, but it's mostly operated by foreign companies under the American flag. Very few American flag companies operate American flag ships. They're mostly operated by foreign flag. Canada owns the Lykes fleet that's operated by Marine Transport.
Well, now that you're retired, are you actively involved in any of the maritime, or what are some of the things that you do in your retirement?
Well, one is the American Merchantmen Veterans. That's one. I still work with the Siemens Institute down there. When I work there's a church here that supports that, one of the supporters. Okay. And I work with them through that church. I volunteer maybe 3 or 4 times a year. And I stay involved with the, attend the meetings with the SIU. Occasionally they will call me in to get some advice on some things. Like they say, they want me to keep my hand in. So I maybe twice a year they'll call me in and I'll do some things with them, wait 4 or 5 days.
And you're trying to get recognition for the World War II merchant.
Right. So I'm working for that. And possibly the gods may smile on us and we'll get something before we all die. So I stay active.
Thank you so much.
I hope I've been of service.
Is there anything else you wanted to add about the ship channel or this project?
One of the really unique and fun things that came out of that oral history project was for the 100-year anniversary of the opening of the Houston Ship Channel. It officially opened in 1914. So in 2014, the Houston History Magazine, which is published out of the University of Houston, our alma mater, they do a really nice historical magazine, quarterly down here in Houston. And they did a special on the 100 years of the Houston Ship Channel, the Dredge to Excellence. So some of the interviews ended up in here, and it was, really a neat opportunity to kind of showcase a lot of the history of the area. Your listeners and your viewers can find a copy for this online at the Houston History Magazine.
Well, do you want to tell people where to find your work or how to contact you if they have any questions or want to hire you to maybe write their family history or start an oral history project themselves?
Yes. So I have a website, jasontherriot.com. So JASONTHERIOT, jasontherriot.com. There's plenty of samples of the work that I've done over the years. If you're interested in the podcast show, one is on World War II. So all those interviews I did, I pulled out the voices of the World War II veterans and created an ongoing podcast series. That one's called Frenchie, Stories of French-Speaking Cajuns of World War II, as told by the veterans themselves. And then the other podcast show, which we did 10 episodes, it's called the Energy Pioneers Podcast. And it features interviews, excerpts of interviews from pioneers of the offshore oil and gas industry, many of whom were involved in maritime, whether they were naval architects or there's a very good episode with who was the vice president of Global Marine, which were, they were the founders of the Glomar Challenger and the Glomar Explorer series. These were drill ships that were built for scientific research in the late 1960s and 70s. So it's sort of a collaboration of different industries that have been involved in technological advances in the offshore industry. And one of the projects that I worked on that might interest your folks is a history of a towing company, a third generation towing company called Cenac Towing. They were out of Houma, Louisiana, south of New Orleans. And Cenac Towing Company, Pelican Brand Oysters to Pioneer Tug and Barge. Like I mentioned, the third generation towing company. And it's a history of how they got involved, starting with renting out their oyster luggers to Texaco in the marshes in the shallow bays of South Louisiana in the 1920s. And then gradually through generations, they developed one of the pioneering tugboat and barge operations in the Gulf Coast. And today, one of the more successful privately operated tank barge operators in the United States, just south of New Orleans. So these are the kind of things I get to do, write histories of unique companies and people and industries, and also do some podcasting like this one. So it's been a pleasure to be on with you, Amy, and your audience.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of Ship History Radio. To learn more about our organization, visit sshsa.org.